Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Here in New York City, a pleasant surprise. An increase in home ownership and a decrease in foreclosures. Vicki Bean is director of the Furman Center for Real Estate and Urban Policy at NYU, which recently published its 10th annual State of New York City's Housing and Neighborhoods Report. Vicki, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Thank you. Well, thanks for having me.
Home buy. You find a 22% increase in the number of home buyers taking out mortgages in low and moderate income neighborhoods of New York City. Wow, isn't this the least likely place for home buying to start?
Well, it may be that those neighborhoods have a lot of opportunities for home purchasing, right? Of course, a lot of our low and moderate income neighborhoods have seen a great deal of foreclosure, so there are opportunities available in the stock, but also some of those neighborhoods are you know very much on the way. They're on the way up. I mean they are changing, and so they provide opportunities.
So can we call this a silver lining of the housing bust? I remember when the housing bubble first burst in 2008, and one of the most stinging comments that we got from one of our listeners on our comments page was, "Does this mean we get our neighborhoods back?" And so is the seamier side of gentrification being reversed? Is there more affordable housing stock for more people to actually enter the market? And, you know, maybe on reasonable mortgage terms, people who can actually afford their mortgages than before?
Well, I think there is a silver lining in that decreases in home prices obviously make the homes more affordable to a broader range of people. I think not to be Debbie Downer here, but the difficulty is that, of course, we're seeing rents increase, and a lot of people are now in the rental market rather than in the home purchase market.
Because they can't afford to buy, so there's more demand to rent, and so rental prices are going up.
Well, they can't afford to buy. The buy-rent equation doesn't look good to them, or they can't get a mortgage, right? And mm-hmm. It's that latter that I think is really the most significant, although our reports show that there's an increase in the number of mortgages being taken out. There are still a huge number of people who don't qualify for mortgages under today's underwriting standards.
And so this 22% increase in the number of homebuyers taking out mortgages in low and moderate income neighborhoods, who are those folks? Do you know demographically or by any other measure?
Well, what we do know is that only 15% of the borrowers who were purchasing homes in the low and moderate income neighborhoods were low and moderate income borrowers themselves.
Uh-huh.
So we can't break out their demographics in a fine-toothed way, but we do know that the vast majority, 85% of them, are not low and moderate income buyers.
So they're either speculators or landlords who are going to turn around and rent those units out?
Well, or they may be people who are right above that threshold who see opportunities in the neighborhood. So it may be that it may include some number of speculators. That's hard to tell, right? It's hard to tell just mm-hmm. from the data.
Foreclosures. You find that the number of properties that receive notices of foreclosure in the city declined in the last year by about 28%. Also, the number of properties entering bank ownership fell by 81% during the same period. That sounds like good news, like the foreclosure crisis is starting to ease, at least in the city.
I think that is good news, that we are seeing many fewer notices of foreclosure being issued, and we're certainly seeing a very significant drop in the number of properties that are going that are real estate owned. I won't say that the crisis is over quite yet, because there are a huge number of foreclosures in the pipeline. As you know, the mm-hmm. the foreclosure process in New York City is long is putting it mildly, right? We've got the longest foreclosure process in the nation by a long shot.
Why? Is that because there are more protections for the owners?
Well, first of all, New York is a judicial state rather than a non-judicial state, which means that the foreclosure has to go through the judicial process. Traditionally, judicial foreclosure has taken longer than other than non-judicial foreclosure, so that's one aspect of it. But a second aspect of it is that we do have a number of protections. The pre-foreclosure notice, where lenders are now required to give 90 days notice before they issue a foreclosure notice. So that has elongated the period somewhat. A second thing that has elongated the period is the Chief Judge of New York required that lawyers who sign papers actually swear that they have looked at those papers and are attesting to their validity, and that has slowed things down somewhat. So for a variety of reasons, we have a very long process, which can be helpful to some borrowers as they struggle to get back on their feet and to work out a modification. It can also be hurtful to neighborhoods if you have an empty, a vacant house sitting there, not being taken care of, then the long process to get that house back into, an owner-occupant is difficult for the neighborhood.
Vicki Bean, director of the Furman Center for Real Estate and Urban Policy at NYU, which has published its 10th annual State of New York City's Housing and Neighborhoods report with some of the very interesting stats that we've been discussing so far. 212-433-WNYC. And Vern in Harlem, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I actually wanted to say that I live in Central Harlem, and I live in a building that I moved into about 2 years ago. It's a co-op conversion program. And the apartment that my wife and I moved into is 9 rooms, 2 bathrooms. We'll be paying less than $100,000 for it when the building converts, and the maintenance is below $1,500. So it's a program that is sponsored by the HPD.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what they do is they take properties that had derelict landlords and they convert them. Like either they were city-owned properties or they had landlords that didn't pay the taxes. And then they try to convert them into affordable housing for low- and middle-income tenants.
So it sounds like that's going to work well for you. Are you bringing this up because you think this is something that's out there that more people who don't know about it yet could take advantage of?
Yes. Actually, the developer that we have is UHAB, and they're one of the biggest ones. And I think they have about 100 buildings in their portfolio. But there's a list of about – if you go to the HPD website, there's a list of about 50 developers that are doing this citywide. So I think they're concentrated in areas in Harlem or northern Manhattan, the Bronx, and Brooklyn.
I'm so glad you brought it up, because it's one of the most important things we can do on this program is let people know about things like that that they could take advantage of to help them. Vicki Bean, are you familiar with that particular program?
Yes. I mean, the city has poured enormous investment over the last few decades into building up New York City's affordable housing stock, its subsidized housing stock, and that is one of the programs. The caller is right on that UHAB is one of the nonprofit developers who works hard to make housing affordable for New Yorkers, and so it's a great program. Unfortunately, as in almost all of these programs, have very long waiting lists,
right,
and the applications for the few apartments are very significant.
Vern, thanks again for pointing that out, though. So people should contact HPD, the city's Housing Preservation and Development Department, or I guess the company that he mentioned, UHAB. Your report finds that Queens is the most racially diverse of the city's boroughs. I think we knew that. But also with the highest percentage of integrated neighborhoods. So in Jackson Heights, real estate-owned stock declined by 50% at the end of last year. What does that mean?
The real estate-owned portfolios are both properties that are entering REO, which means that the bank bought them at the auction itself rather than there was no third-party buyer, who who met the bank's reservation price. So you have stock going into the REO stock. And then, of course, as the banks sell it to private borrowers, then it leaves the REO stock. So what's happening is you're seeing fewer properties go into the REO stock, and you're seeing a great many of them now being sold out to hopefully owner-occupiers, investors who are, we hope, improving the properties and then turning around and selling them.
And only 7 were repossessed and 23 sold in Jackson Heights. Is there something unique going on in that neighborhood?
No, I think that it's a citywide trend that the REO stock is not, you know, is winding down, is getting smaller. So, you know, I don't think that Jackson Heights is exceptional in that area. In other areas, but not in that one.
Mm-hmm. And Manhattan, no surprise, you find has the highest income disparity in the city. And looking at the Lower East Side and Chinatown, for example, you found that recent arrivals to the housing stock spent less of their income on rent than renters who have lived there longer. Why would that be, assuming that the people who have been there longer have more access to rent-stabilized apartments?
Well, that we find across the city that renters who have been in their apartments longer are paying less than renters who are on the market right now. And in part that's because we think that many landlords do not increase rents on sitting tenants at the same rate that they increase rents on new tenants. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the issue. A second part of the issue is that, of course, with rent regulation, many of those tenants that have been in their apartments for longer are more likely to be rent regulated, and therefore.
Oh, so it's the opposite of what I said. It's that the new arrivals are paying more, not less. Correct?
Right. Right.
Oh, that makes sense.
So yeah, so the new arrivals, typically the new arrivals are having to pay more. It varies across the city, but typically they're having to pay more.
We just have a couple of minutes left. Let me get in a question about property taxes, because you also found that owners of New York City's large rental apartment buildings pay a higher effective property tax than owners of 1-3 family homes. Why is this the case as a matter of policy?
Well, as a matter of policy, that difference is really about politics. There's a long history of homeowners paying less in property taxes, a lower effective rate than renters, and of course, owners tend to vote in higher percentages than renters do. There's a long history dating back to a 1975 court order ordering that the assessments be at full value to try to reduce disparities.
But the renters don't pay the property taxes directly. Their landlords pay it and pass it on. But don't the landlords have a lot of political clout?
The landlords have political clout, but perhaps or obviously not in the same percentage as the, millions of homeowners who vote, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got landlords who certainly have political influence and who give campaign contributions and get their members out to vote, but you also have, a great many homeowners.
And there we leave it. Some of the really interesting findings from the Furman Center for Real Estate and Urban Policy at NYU, their 10th annual State of New York City's Housing and Neighborhoods Report. Vicki Bean is director of the Furman Center. Thank you so much. It's been fascinating.
Thank you.